This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Steve McQueen's much-anticipated new film, 12 Years a Slave, is out in theaters. While it's not generating big audience, it has been getting high marks from film critics for its unflinching portrayal of the brutality of slavery. It's based on an 1853 autobiography of Solomon Northrop, a free black man living in Saratoga, New York, who was kidnapped and eventually bought by a sadistic plantation owner named Edwin Epps. Northrop was rescued, and his memoir sold some 30,000 copies. Here's a scene from the film where Northrop, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, is talking with other kidnapped slaves.
Days ago, I was with my family in my home. Now you tell me all is lost. Tell no one who I am. That's the way to survive. Well, I don't want to survive. I want to live.
Today in Radio Times, we discuss Northrop's narrative, McQueen's film, and the legacy of slavery. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Stephen Hahn is a specialist on the history of the American South, African American history, 19th century American history, and the international history of slavery, emancipation, and race. He's the Roy F. and Jeanette P. Nichols Professor of History, author of a number of books, including most recently The Political Worlds of Slavery and Freedom, and back in 2004, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, A Nation Under Our Feet. Steve Hahn, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us is John L. Jackson. He's the Richard Perry University Professor of Communication, Africana Studies, and Anthropology, also at the University of Pennsylvania. Author of, most recently, Thin Description, Ethnography and the African Hebrew Israelites of Jerusalem. And John, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Wonderful to be back. Thanks.
Let me put the question to both of you, but Steve, I'll start with you. Is this an important film?
I think it's a very important film to watch. It is powerful. It is emotionally draining, as anyone who's seen it already would know. It deals with slavery. I think the word you said was unflinching, and I think that is true. I think it gets to the heart of how the slave system was organized, and I found it riveting, and I think it's a very important film for all Americans to see.
Do you agree with that, John?
100%. I think there's a lot of hype around the film, critical hype, and so it meant my expectations were really high. I don't think it's a perfect film, but I think it really takes the subject matter incredibly seriously and does it in a way that is both unflinching, I think, but also very enlightening in a way. I think you leave the theater thinking differently about your world, and that's an important intervention.
Well, here's a quote from Steve McQueen, and he has done two other films, and I should say he was a visual artist before he became a filmmaker. He did one called Hunger about Bobby Sands and Ireland, and he did one called Shame about a man with a sexual addiction. But nonetheless, this is what Steve McQueen said about 12 Years a Slave. I made this film because I wanted to visualize a time in history that hadn't been visualized that way. I wanted to see the lash on someone's back. I wanted to see the aftermath of that, psychological and physical. I feel sometimes people take slavery very lightly, to be honest. I hope it could be a starting point for them to delve into the history and somehow reflect on the position where they are now. And he wants us to see the brutality of slavery, and we do.
Mm-hmm. We absolutely do. One of the things that's certainly true of the film and of the narrative, and it's very true to the narrative, I think, by and large, with some changes or simplifications here and there, is that there is an abolitionist a depiction of slavery, of which this is a part, and Solomon Northup worked with someone on this who actually was not an abolitionist, but many of the other slave narratives of the period, this was true. And the suffering of the body, the infliction of pain on the body, was a central part of trying to not only show how heinous slavery was, but to try to win the sympathy of white audiences in the North, few of whom cared very much about African Americans at all. The white critique of slavery in the United States in the first half of the 19th century focused much more on its retrograde influences on the American economy, on American culture, even on what Jefferson talked about, its negative impact on white people, but not so much on black people. So the image of the lashed back is really iconic in the abolitionist literature.
And John, we see that. I mean, this is a director that forces us to watch people being whipped, being beaten.
I think the one powerful scene with Patsy towards the end is a scene, if you watch it, you can never watch any movie violence the same way again. And it is sort of very intimate, horrifying, and I think also at the very same time, it does a nice job of actually, ironically enough, almost humanizing that experience. And because this wasn't about some demonized, stereotype white master, you know, obliviously just brutalizing a slave. This was about a relationship and a complicated psychology that undergirded slavery in a way that, I mean, I think one of the ironies of the film is I think it does such an incredible job depicting various kinds of white complicity, but in a way that isn't about stereotyping white racism, but showing just how much, like Stephen said, the impact of this institution was clearly on the Africans themselves in America, but also such a debilitating and incredibly punishing impact psychologically on the white folks who had to, in various different kinds of ways, be complicit in the system.
Well, and we should say that the Patsy was, I don't even know what the word is, but Epps is obsessed with her and has sex with her. I mean, clearly, as it's shown in the film, this is not something that she wants, but it does allow her to have this kind of favored status. And then she asks, or I guess the slave owner then has Northrop lash her in his stead.
Yeah, and so he's doing a whole bunch of different things. That he's dealing with his white wife, the mistress of the plantation, who has always been angry at Patsy for something Patsy can't control, right? The anger is really at her husband and the ways in which he's able to manipulate the system to get all of these extra sexual perks from his slave, especially his chosen slave, right? And she's chosen not just because of her beauty. We don't even hear talk about her aesthetically, but she's a really good slave in the sense that she can bail a lot of cotton. And she is clearly someone who represents a version of what he imagines to be the kind of perfect black female specimen in a way. And so it's about just him both manipulating and abusing Patsy, manipulating and in some ways acquiescing to the violence of his wife, but also clearly Northrop. I mean, it's about also finding another way to beat up on this slave who clearly is a little bit uppity, maybe even dangerous, but he wants to make sure he's constantly showing him who's boss. And forcing him to whip one of his compatriots is a major power play.
You know, Steve, as I was watching, and I have to say there are, I mean, scenes of just unbelievable brutality. It's very difficult to watch. But to me, it was about terrorism. It's about one group of people. Terrorizing another group of people and how frightening it must have been to live under that.
You know, what the film does so effectively, on the one hand, precisely by making the white population of the South more complicated than we might see it. There's the Ford character, who is the relatively benevolent owner. There's the Tibbetts character, who is the harsh carpenter. There's Epps, of course, in this film. There's the wife, and it's part of what we learn is the way in which slavery creates enormous conflict among different groups of white people. But what comes over in the most powerful way is the central role of terror in maintaining the regime. I mean, slavery is not not organized around repressing people. It's organized around forcing people to work. But how do you do that? And the terror is that regardless of who your owner is, regardless of what they would choose to do in rational moments, that what the system produces is a set of circumstances under which you can be exposed to the most extreme brutality at any moment. Mm. And whether you've ever been whipped in your entire life, and there were slaves who were never whipped, or whether you were there was a whipping every week or every day on the plantation, it didn't matter. And whether the planter or the government official, because we see the sheriff at the end, was upstanding and decent, or whether they were vicious and brutes, it didn't matter. And I think that there's this really interesting moment in the film between Eliza and Northup, who's known as Platt at that point. And Eliza has been basically weeping since she's been separated from her children. And Northup, they're on the Ford plantation, and Northup is basically telling her to get hold of herself. And after all, they have a pretty decent owner. And Eliza turns to him and basically says, he's just like everybody else, because when push comes to shove, and one of the things you don't see in the film that's depicted slightly, that's different in the narrative, is that he's initially sold by Ford to Tibbetts. Uh-huh. And he's sold by to Tibbetts because Ford effectively goes bankrupt. And this is one of the issues in the terror of the regime.
Well, and not to give too much away, but just picking up on this notion that you were always at risk, you were always under some state of terror, even under this relatively benign slave owner, Northrop is punished, and punished in the most kind of brutal kind of way, nearly hung to death. And what Steve McQueen does as the director is the camera doesn't move. I don't know how long it sat there. And you see almost like a tableau, people walking and sort of going about their way. Meanwhile, Northrop is on his tippy toes trying to save his life.
No, and one of the things you won't forget, and you're right, we don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen the film, but you get a sense of just how easy it was to live with that terror. In a sense, part of what, you know, both the slave master and the other slaves on the plantation have to do is go on. So to see how he juxtaposes the kind of the symbolic violence of him hanging by a rope, right, all on the tippy toes, or what's, you know, separating him from his own demise, we see the kind of unfolding of the day on the plantation, almost as though he is in a way that is so flabbergasting. Mm. I feel like, but also it seems to me a nice depiction of just what we mean by terrorism. Terror isn't, you know, you're cowering in a corner somewhere until the world begins again. It's having to live in a world where the terror is always in your midst, and trying to find a way in some ways to routinize it and to domesticate it. It's impossible, but you have to do that. You can't even survive.
Yeah, we're almost about to break here. Anything you want to add to that, Steve, about that particular scene?
Well, you know, I thought also it was a very disturbing moment, precisely because the overseer chases off Tibbetts and his accomplices who were going to hang Northup at that moment, and then leaves him there. And Ford ultimately comes back and cuts the rope. But still, I think John's point is really important, the normalization of violence, brutality, and terror.
Well, we're going to take a very short break. We are talking about the new film, 12 Years a Slave. It is out in theaters, has been winning critical acclaim. And our guests are Steve Hahn, a history professor at the University of Pennsylvania, John L. Jackson, a professor of communication, Africana studies, and anthropology, also at the University of Pennsylvania. We have seen the film. We'd love to have you join our conversation. Hopefully you have seen it as well. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499, or perhaps you read Northrop's memoir. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra and the music of Richard Strauss. Yannick Nezet-Séguin leads Strauss's self-portrait, Ein Heldenleben. And Yuja Wang plays Prokofiev's third piano concerto. Tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Strauss's Ein Heldenleben with Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
The Y12K is back Saturday, November 9th. A day of outdoor fun and fitness for all ages. Test your limits with the 12K Road Race. Dress as your favorite Mr. Rogers character or Fred himself for the Fred 5K. There's the laid-back 3K walk run, perfect for families. And as always, PBS Kids characters and fun games at the Y Kids Family Fit Zone. The Y12K, supporting WHYY. Learn more and sign up at whyy.org/Y12K.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, a food writer and proud Southerner shares recipes from his mother's kitchen and her secret to longevity.
She was going strong, drinking Jack Daniels every day, eating fried chicken, you name it, fried grits, fried okra.
Fried everything. Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about the new film 12 Years a Slave, a story that comes from the 1853 autobiography by Solomon Northrop. He was a free African-American living in Saratoga, New York. He was kidnapped, sold into slavery, and eventually ended up living on a plantation owned by a very cruel master or owner, if I can say. We're talking about Northrop's narrative, the legacy of slavery, and how films have handled this subject, this history in the past. And again, our guests are John L. Jackson and Stephen Hahn from the University of Pennsylvania. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Steve, I mean, this is an unusual, because it's not exactly a slave narrative, or perhaps it is a slave narrative, but written by someone who lived until he was a slave as a free black man.
Right. Most of the slave narratives that were written in the period before the end of slavery, because there are many other narratives, start in slavery and end up outside of slavery. Whether we want to call it freedom or not is another matter. This, of course, inverts the story and begins, in some ways, it's not unlike a very famous narrative by Alodowe Equiano in the 18th century, who begins his narrative as a free person in West Africa and ends up in slavery and then ends up in freedom. But to that extent, it's really unusual. And it's unusual for some other reasons. Most of the slave narratives we have were written by people who were living in the Upper South, Maryland, Kentucky, not surprisingly, because of their proximity to the Ohio River and the Mason-Dixon line. It's a long way to freedom. Solomon Northup ends up in Louisiana. Now, in truth, people who slaves who lived in Louisiana and Texas who wanted to escape go to Mexico. And in fact, one of the parts in the book, the narrative that doesn't make it into the film, is that Northup does tell us that there was a conspiracy in the area where he would show up before he arrived to raise a rebellion and to head to Mexico. But it is one of the rare narratives from that deal with life in the Deep South.
And do we know, did he write this?
Well, what we do know is that he worked with a white writer who was a state legislator and a writer in his own right, who was not an abolitionist. Most of these narratives are written in collaboration with people who are involved in the anti-slavery movement. This was not the case, although this was somebody who took a real interest. But it's been studied very closely by historians. Most of the points in the narrative have been authenticated, and it turns out that Northup was interviewed in Washington shortly after he was taken out of slavery, and the story he tells in the interview is very much like the story that is told, with more power and verbal eloquence in the narrative.
And in the film, and I've begun to read the narrative, but the depiction of life for free blacks in the North, although it should be said that there were slaves in the North as well, and we do see some of them in the film, and he remarks on them in his narrative as well. How free were they?
Well, you know, this is one of the issues that Northup does deal with a little better than Steve McQueen does, but I understand the choice that was made. Northup's father was a slave, and what it does remind us of is that slavery was legal in all of the American colonies at the time of the American Revolution, and that even as northern states abolished slavery, they did so very gradually. I mean, slavery died a long and agonizing death. Many people who were enslaved in the North ended up being indentured servants of various sorts. At the very least, they ended up at the lower rungs of the economic and social ladder. Northup himself really came on economic harder times. I mean, he was a hack driver, and his wife basically was a servant in a hotel. And the reason he got into trouble is he needed the money. And so you get, I think, a slightly embellished view because, like abolitionists, McQueen, too, is playing off the contrast between North and mm-hmm. South and between white people in the North and South. And it does. It enables us to avoid two related issues. One is the way in which slavery was embedded in the entire United States, and the second thing is how deeply entrenched racism became in the free states, because it's there that the system of Jim Crow really begins, not in the South in the late 19th century.
Let me turn to you, John. And I was thinking about some of the other movies that we have seen. Django is a kind of about avenging slave, but also The Butler that came out this year about a butler that worked in the White House. 42 about Jackie Robinson. You were a guest on the show a year or so ago talking about The Help. Another movie that looks at race or history of race relations in this country. Do you see this? Do you see us as a nation beginning to address some of these issues, whether through movies or perhaps even TV shows, things like that?
At a certain level, I think I'd give us enough credit to say there's always someone who wants to have a conversation, who is able to find a venue where they can produce a text that we can talk over. And so I think what makes this a little bit different is most of the other films are kind of really using the institution of slavery as a kind of complicated and sophisticated backdrop for a different story. This really was a story about slavery. That's the center of the bullseye. And I think maybe that's what makes it slightly different from all of the other films that you list. For those, we can't talk about the story they're trying to unpack without situating it in America's racial history. But with this one, this was specifically, almost exclusively, in an unblinking way, about what racism mm-hmm. has meant to the founding and the development of the nation state. And I think that makes it a little bit distinctive.
Well, and I know you took some students to see the movie yesterday. I'd be just curious about their response. What did they see?
Well, we went on Saturday night, actually, and I'll tell you, when we emerged from the theater, we were all a bit shell-shocked. It's the kind of film where you just need a few minutes to kind of, in some ways, come back to yourself. And so what we ended up doing was we ended up finding a restaurant nearby, getting some food, some drinks. These are graduate students.
Yes, they're loud.
And just talking through the film and just trying to figure out if we all even saw the same kinds of things, because we didn't, actually. And so that was also fascinating, to just try to figure out how it was we could come out of this film with very different glosses on what McQueen was trying to do and what they imagined maybe the object lesson of the story.
But was that along generational lines or racial lines or gender lines?
Not that I could see, really. I mean, I think most of the comments that came up that other people didn't necessarily think about initially resonated with everyone else at the mm-hmm. table. So that was interesting as well. So one thing I know that we really talked about for a while was the relative silence about, now this is going to sound maybe a little bit counterintuitive because Patsy's a key character.
Yes.
But this film is about Northrop, and there's so much about the way in which the film seems to almost posit black female enslavement as even more brutal. I mean, it opens with this really odd scene that we come back to, but we don't get explicated at all, that really is about black women on the plantation, and the relative marginalization of that story in this particular narrative was something that I think we talked about a lot.
Go ahead, Steve. We'll get to our colleagues.
I would say that, in fact, if you read the narrative, one of the things that's striking is the importance of female characters. There is one part in the narrative that is not in the film where he talks about four women who end up showing up on the plantation, and he talks about their strength and the field work they can do. And of course, as John mentioned, Patsy distinguished herself by far among all of the slaves, male and female, as a cotton picker. The one thing I wanted to say about the film that is maybe runs up against some of the ways in which it's been received. We have to remember that for a long time, slavery was not represented in American films, even films that were about the South during this period. Then, of course, we have the Roots experience. And I think since then, there have been many films that have depicted the violence and brutality of slavery. I think one of the things that's true about this film that is kind of characteristic of the American slavery to freedom narrative is that this is a redemption story. And one of the things you don't learn is that at the very end, Solomon Northup gets very little money as a result of this narrative. He and his family do buy some land, and they end up in kind of a self-segregated black community in the North. So while it plays to interracial alliances that were clearly significant to his rescue, nonetheless, I think it's part of a long-standing redemption story that that makes us feel a little better. By the end of the film, you feel brutalized, but on the other hand, you know, he gets out and he is helped by white people.
And that's Stephen Hahn, who joins us along with John L. Jackson. We're talking about the film 12 Years a Slave, and based on a narrative by Solomon Northup, a narrative written in 1853. It sold about 30,000 copies. The movie has been getting some critical acclaim and raises a whole host of questions and issues about how we view our slave history. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499 and email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Let me get Bill from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Bill, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife and I went to see the film on Friday evening. It was kind of a last-minute decision, and we weren't quite sure what to expect. It was incredibly powerful, I have to say that. But there were a couple of things that, and I realized that no film can cover all aspects, but I would have appreciated it had they dealt with the attempted prosecutions later of those who had kidnapped him, those who had enslaved him, those who had actually violated law, and yet he loses those cases in both Washington, D.C. and in New York. And I think that's an important aspect because we today look to the justice system to be that great equalizer. And we continuously see that it's not. And I think that's an important piece of this that unfortunately I think got left out.
Well, Bill, I appreciate you raising that. And actually, let me toss that to you, Stephen Hahn, because he does try to pursue some kind of legal redress.
Not only Northup, but his white allies try to help him out. This is a very good question, and what it does do is it points to the way in which the legal system and the national government are very deeply implicated in the maintenance of slavery. The Fugitive Slave Law has been reenacted in 1850. In many of the northern states, African Americans do not have equal civil standing in the courts. One of the problems is in Washington, D.C., where they try to go after one of the slave traders, Solomon Northup can't testify. So that was the end of that. And then they attempt to go after the two men who brought him to Washington, and that falls apart. So I think it is an example of the many challenges that African Americans all over the United States face, and the way in which, really until the Civil War, the federal government was one of the main supports of the system of slavery.
Let me see what... actually, we have an email from Laura from Swarthmore. She said she saw the movie yesterday. She said the most disappointing part of the experience was that there were only six people in the entire theater. And we were actually talking about this a bit before we went on the air, John. But, I mean, it is... People have said to me, is it a good movie? And I say, yes, it's a good movie. Should I go see it? And I say, you should go see it, but be prepared.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, it's a kind of story that a lot of people would rather not have to hear. Right, and I get that for a whole bunch of reasons. Part of what I think maybe just going back to Bill's question also, that I think is really important for me. The reason why I know it's a good film, whether or not people in the theater, is because I came out of there, and I'm a filmmaker. I'm committed to the genre of the feature-length motion picture. But I said, wow, what kind of story would this be if this were an HBO series? You know, if we could have the time to see these characters develop, to see even the kind of legal...
More than 2 hours.
Exactly. I mean, so I think there's a way in which, as media consumers in the contemporary moment, we're so spoiled. Because now our movies last for 12 years, actually 12 years. You know, and so I think there's something about maybe the nuances of a story like this that... Again, HBO can get away with this because they don't need ratings quite the way, you know, everyone else does. And I think that would have been a way to, in some ways, feed that beast we have, which is we want all the details. There's so much of this story that ended up not even on the cutting room floor. They just weren't in the script because they couldn't have done it. I think Ridley wrote a very crisp and clear motion picture. But I think there's so much about this story that was on the kind of margins of the frame that would have been incredible to see unpacked.
Imagine a 12-part series, 12-hour-long series of this, Stephen Hahn.
I don't know if we could actually endure that. You know, when I went to see it, the audience was, I would say, 90% African-American. And it did make me wonder who was going to see the film. And what we do with this film. You know, I remember a number of years ago, there was a very powerful exhibit on slavery in New York at the New York Historical Society, and I went up to see it. And the most interesting part of the film, of the exhibit, was watching people walk through it. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't even know that there ever was slavery in New York, let alone that it was as significant to the social and economic development of the city. So this is potentially a very interesting moment for the entire country and a teachable one, but we have to figure out how we want to teach this.
You know, I was thinking as even preparing for the show today is that not that everyone runs out to see movies about the Holocaust, but nonetheless, there have been many movies about the Holocaust, including Schindler's List, which got all those awards. And I want to see whether it's easier for us to go to the movies about the Holocaust because it's about those people versus movies about slavery, which is about us.
I think we've always had a great deal of difficulty coming to terms with slavery. For a long time, we brushed it under the rug and just denied it or effectively accepted the perspective of people who were slave owners. I think the story, the way we've come to deal with it, is this slavery to freedom narrative, which is we repent for our sins of slavery by pointing to the many ways in which we try to rectify those wrongs. And that's what has enabled us when Barack Obama, I mean, an extraordinary moment, to talk about a post-racial society. So in a sense, the slavery to freedom narrative is staring itself in the face as we recognize that we're not in a post-racial society and try to figure out how to deal with it and explain it.
You're nodding your head, John.
I mean, I think there's so much about what makes people uncomfortable about the story of slavery that isn't about history itself per se at all. It's about what its implications are for how we make sense of the present situation we find ourselves in as a nation state and what it implies for our commitments to things like meritocracy and equality and justice. And I think that becomes part of what I think maybe is so difficult for folks to deal with. Because if you take slavery seriously, some of the ways in which we structure our debates about things like affirmative action, about inclusion and diversity, would have to be formulated very, very differently. In some ways, to be able to talk about contemporary issues the way we do means we have to pretend a lot of our past away. And I think that's part of what this film doesn't allow us to do, because part of what you're seeing feels so contemporary. And that's, I think, another wonderful and delicious irony of the film. You're looking at actors who are portraying this in a way that has a psychology that seems very much in the present. These are folks who aren't holdovers from another era. They're individuals who could live next door to you, just in a very different situation and circumstance.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's John L. Jackson, who joins us along with Stephen Hahn, and again talking about the new film, 12 Years a Slave, by director Steve McQueen, and based on the 1853 autobiography of Solomon Northrop, a real live autobiography. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499 and emails as well, radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Natural Lands Trust supports WHYY and invites you to find yourself outside. With 42 nature preserves spanning eastern Pennsylvania and southern New Jersey, Natural Lands Trust is a getaway to nature. To learn more about preserves, upcoming events, and how your support can help save open space, natlands.org. That's natlands.org. Natural Lands Trust. Land for life.
Iranian-American journalist Hooman Maj writes that the path of the Iranian Revolution, modernity fused with religion, is unique in the world. On the next Fresh Air, he describes his year in Tehran with his wife and child. His new book is called The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. Friends Select, the Center City Quaker School, supports WHYY. Friends Select combines academics with real-world exploration in the classroom, in Philadelphia, and beyond. By asking questions and inviting students to make independent discoveries, Friends Select teachers do more than instruct. They strive to spark lasting fascination. An open house is Monday, November 11th. Full details at friends-select.org. Friends Select, fascination, forever bright.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. In 1853, Solomon Northrop wrote a memoir titled 12 Years a Slave, a story, his own story, of a free black man who experienced the violence, the cruelty, and the degradation of slavery. British director Steve McQueen tells Northrop's story in his new film, 12 Years a Slave. We're talking about the film and the narrative, the legacy of slavery, and how other movies have handled some of this history. And again, Stephen Hahn, a history professor at the University of Pennsylvania, joining us, most recently the author of The Political Worlds of Slavery and Freedom. I should add that almost 10 years ago, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, A Nation Under Our Feet. John L. Jackson, a professor of communication, Africana Studies, and Anthropology at Penn, and author most recently of Thin Description, Ethnography and the African Hebrew Israelites of Jerusalem. Let me see what it looks like Anita from Roxborough has to say. And Anita, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, my name's Anita Lewis. I am an African-American woman, and I wanted to say that this was the most violent, other than Passion of the Christ, this was the most violent movie that I've ever seen in my life, and there is nothing that I could see positive or beneficial in exposing people to such horror and brutality and torture. And there's nothing that I saw positive. I went to the movie with my boyfriend, and we had a very serious debate, almost an argument. And because he thought it was a positive movie, I thought it was very negative. Right. And there was absolutely nothing that I could say that was good about that movie. Nothing, because it was so violent. And I was listening to one of your speakers talk about other movies that depicted slavery, and that they didn't show the brutality enough, I guess, for lack of a better word. And I would totally disagree, because other movies, and I'm trying to think of the name, Django was one, mm-hmm. Roots was another, and then the movie that Steven Spielberg directed.
Amistad.
I can't remember the name of that
Amistad.
Amistad. That was so violent. And this movie was just so violent.
Well,
and
Anita,
so brutal.
Let me take your point. And actually, I'm going to toss that to you, John L. Jackson, because she has a very different perspective on this film. And it is very violent. There's no question about it.
I don't even think it's the most violent film I've seen this week. I think it's about the nature of how that violence is depicted, maybe. And so I think in some ways I would say there are two different things that we might be able to say in response to what I think is a very honest mm-hmm. and important critique. One is, you know, this is the violence of the system being depicted. It's not like the filmmaker concocted this out of whole cloth from his, you know, from his mind. This is him trying to do justice to the violence of that moment. But I think the other thing is, there's something about this violence maybe that seems less cartoonish and over the top than some of the Tarantino and Hollywood forms of violence. So there's much more violence in I think most of your average Hollywood films, even Hollywood films about this era. But the violence here is smaller. I think it's more intimate, and there's something about the way in which it's represented that makes us all feel complicit in that moment, especially the moment we talked about earlier, in ways that the other films don't quite produce. And I think, so I can see why one's reaction might be to say, well, this is just too much. It's like Steve said earlier, like, can you even handle much more? And I think part of his point is to say, it should be difficult to handle this. It shouldn't go down easy.
Well, and it's interesting, Anita, I appreciate the call, because I also thought of The Passion of the Christ because of the lashes to the body. Steve, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think John used, the appropriate word, which was the intimacy of the violence and our feeling of complicity with it. In a way, what it helps us understand is what the terror of the system was. It wasn't necessary for everyone on a plantation or farm to be whipped. All you had to do was see this once. And what it meant to inflict that kind of pain. Now, there is that scene with Patsy when Northup is initially forced to whip her. What you don't know is actually he was a driver on this plantation and was in the field with whips. And what he learned, as other drivers did, was how to look as though you were inflicting punishment while not inflicting it to the extent that it could have been. And you'll remember that when he began to do it, he's eventually pulled off because they don't feel he's doing enough. So I understand the caller, and I think that is an important issue to raise. But I do think that it's about forcing us to recognize how, as both as viewers and as Americans, we are kind of implicated in this.
Anita, I appreciate that call to Radio Times. But I was also thinking it's the violence, but it's, and I'll toss this back to you, Steve, and then we'll get to our caller, back to our callers, the sort of daily humiliations of being a slave.
That's right. It's about enforcing submission. And submission is enforced in a whole variety of ways, some of which involve no violence at all, although their violence is embedded in what happens. So you learn that slaveholders attempt to bring Christianity to the slaves. It's of course done so in a way to enforce submission. Other forms, they have the scene in the slave market, which I think is one of the most powerful in the film and maybe the best I've ever seen depicting slave trading, talks about the humiliations of the body.
Indeed. Let me see what looks like Stephen from West Philadelphia has to say. And Stephen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning, Marty.
Good morning.
And good morning to your guests, Dr. Hahn and Dr. Jackson.
Thanks.
Really, my comment is just to underscore what was just been said, that when I saw the film, I was struck again at how slavery was an American institution. It wasn't just about cruel people doing cruel things. It was something that was legal, that was instituted, that gave people an identity that they had to maintain. If you were told you were uneducated, you were told you couldn't read, or you were told that you could be dismissive, or told you could be controlling, or you could use this person as a sex object, and it was all within the system, people fit these roles and had difficulty escaping them because they're reinforced not just by people in that plantation, but by the whole society. And that's the remnant that's still with us, that element of this is who you are. We have created you to be this, and you can't get outside of that identity.
Well, that's a very interesting comment. I'm going to toss that to you, John.
And the other thing that really stuck out to me in the film was the idea that there was an inescapability to the violence.
Yeah.
So you had characters who, almost no matter what choice you made, right? You go through door one and you get it from one direction. You go through the second door, you get it, but just from a slightly different angle and from a different antagonist. And I think that part of it is also important to remember. These are folks making there was an impossible choice, right, between a rock and a hard place. And seeing folks try to negotiate that kind of world where there isn't a good option. Right, and part of what I think the film tries to get us to recognize is this is something Solomon Northup himself has to understand, because he doesn't know it. First, he wants to live, not just survive.
But
then he just wants to survive. And that's a completely different mindset. It's a different way of a mode of being in the world. And I think it does a good job at showing us just how you get to that point.
It's there's a couple of scenes in the film when Northup is about to get beaten, first by Tibbetts and then by Epps. And he tries to tell them that he's done exactly what they asked him to do. So there's no rationality to this, and that brutality can be inflicted upon you for no reason whatsoever, and your attempt to use logic is pointless.
It just frustrates them all the more, in a way, right? It
angers them all the more.
Indeed. Let me, Stephen, thanks for the call. Let's see what David from Wayne has to say. And David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I just wanted to, harken back to the last two callers and say, yes, I thought the film did a great job at depicting the depravity and sickness of that so-called institution and the society in general. I think one of the things that I came away with is the extent to which it personalized, for me anyway, the fact that so much of what we look at, even going on today in other places in the world, there's barely anything that we can look at, whether it's people having body parts hacked off or such in genocidal wars or ethnic cleansings that have gone on in other places, that we there's barely anything we can look at and say, well, that never happened here, whether we look at slavery or the plight and I would say genocide and ethnic cleansing of Native Americans. And I'd just like to have the guest comment on that. I mean, they didn't show anyone getting hobbled, for example, but they do open up the scene with a man who's apparently had his hand hacked off in some way or another, but there's no reflection on how that happened.
Well, David, I appreciate the call. Steve, can I toss that first to you?
Yes. You know, the history of both slavery and its aftermath, you know, including lynching, which is not a phenomenon of slavery but of the post-emancipation experience and the brutalization of black bodies. This is something that we still have not really confronted as a society. If you're talking about terror, the number of African Americans who were lynched in the period, say, between 1880 and 1920, which is the high, was relatively few in terms of the total population. But the purpose it served, which was reminding African Americans that if they did not know their place, and if they did not have a white person to vouch for them, and there's ways in which the Northup film suggest this, the importance of having a white person, a well-placed white person to help you out, that you were always vulnerable to the most lethal of violence.
Well, and it's interesting, John, we got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. First of all, I'm glad that people are going out to see this film, but I also think it speaks to a desire to talk. I mean, just to have a difficult conversation about our history, about race, about racial politics, where we are today. And I do believe, I think you do as well, that the movies are a great, or even really good TV shows are a good jumping off point for these kinds of conversations.
I totally agree. And that isn't because we have to come out of the movie with the same impression of what we saw either. But I think to recognize that there's something about what we allow ourselves to forget about our collective past that continues to haunt us in the present moment. And just trying to connect the dots is important for us as citizens in the 21st century to try to figure out how we can get more things right than wrong.
Steve, just a quick question about your Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Nation Under Our Feet. That book, in many ways, was about how blacks freed themselves. I mean, this is a narrative where Northrop is essentially saved by what feels like white abolitionists come down the South and save him.
That's right. And the narrative, the text, paints a much more complex picture of relationships among slaves and the way in which they were able to sustain themselves and how they found out about other things going on in the world around them. He mentions, for example, the U.S.-Mexican War, which they're pleading, they're hoping that a Mexican army is going to invade the United States. You know, this is certainly an issue, and I think the one thing that does worry me about the film is again re-embedding the idea that slavery is a Southern thing, that violence and brutality and extreme racism are Southern things, and that there's a happy ending to the story. I mean, he does get out, and he's able to rejoin his family, and we end it at that point, not with the more complicated picture that follows immediately thereafter.
Let me get to that. Looks like Mary from Reading to join our conversation. And Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Marty and doctors.
Sure.
Doctor, what you just said about slavery being a Southern thing, this movie is so important so that people understand it's a Northern thing, too. I live in Reading right now. I'm from Connecticut. My great-grandfather was a slave owner in Connecticut. And he emancipated his slaves in 1848 when Connecticut abolished slavery.
Oh.
The former slaves lived as servants on the property, really up until the 1920s. But in 1869, I think is the date. It was before 1861. His freed slave, the man working on his property, John, was in New York City bringing crops to the market, and he was kidnapped and taken to Oklahoma. His wife witnessed it, went back to Connecticut, told my great-grandfather, who went with his brother to Oklahoma, hopped a freight car to go get him, and the only way they could get him was to bring the pieces of paper saying they owned him. I'm now in touch with the African side of the family. I have to say they're great-great-grandchildren.
Sure. You know, Mary, I hate to do this only because we're almost out of time here, but you raise another interesting story related to this larger story. And, Steve, I'd love to have you
respond. Well, first of all, that's a fantastic story.
It is indeed.
What I would say, as you mentioned, an interesting date, 1848. Now, Connecticut initially abolished slavery before 1800, but Connecticut did so gradually. And like many of the states, Connecticut had to abolish slavery twice because there were so many ambiguities as to who was free and who was not. So what we do know is that by the end of the 18th century, especially in northern cities, including Newport, Rhode Island, New York, Philadelphia, a very high percentage of free households owned slaves. So it was very much part of the entire social and economic system. And what it meant was that as the crisis over slavery intensified, there were always a substantial number of people in the northern states who sympathized with southern slave owners and looked for a compromise. And part of the importance of this story is how slavery ends.
Well, on that note, first of all, Mary, thank you very much for calling into Radio Times. And my thanks to both of you for joining us as well. Stephen Hahn, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And John L. Jackson, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
And again, both professors at the University of Pennsylvania talking about 12 Years a Slave. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. You can also check us out. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us.